Now, some of you might have been thinking up another question. You might be thinking, well, if there's no place for Buddhism in God, then according to Buddhism, who created this world? It didn't just appear overnight. Who created it? Now, Buddhism's answer to that is quite short, quite simple. Buddhism says it's no business of religions to answer this question as to what is the origin of the world. This is what we would call today a scientific question. If you want to know how the world originated, don't ask Buddhism, ask science. Buddhism is not concerned with questions of this sort. So what is Buddhism concerned with? Buddhism is concerned with the moral and spiritual perfection or perfecting of the individual for his own sake and for the sake of all. This is what it's concerned with. And one can perfect oneself morally and spiritually without recourse to, without reference to, any particular theories or doctrines, hypotheses or speculations about the origin of this material universe. It just doesn't make any difference. If religion says to you, well, speak the truth, don't tell a lie, you don't need to know, in order to practice that, whether the universe originated, say, 1,000 million years ago, of its own accord, spontaneously, or whether God created it, it's irrelevant. So Buddhism says, put aside all these questions, which really belong to science. Don't base your religious life on them. Base your religious life simply upon the laws of your own moral and spiritual development. So that is what Buddhism is concerned with. And Buddhism says that moral and spiritual development don't come about just by chance, as it were. They don't just happen. At present you're all studying. Presumably you want to pass an examination. So in order to pass the examination, you have to study, follow a systematic program of work. Not in a happy-go-lucky fashion, otherwise you won't pass, as you know perfectly well. No doubt. You have to go step by step. Read all the textbooks, do your homework and all that sort of thing. So in the same way, with the moral and spiritual life, it's no use thinking, well, I suppose there's something in religion. I suppose there is something after death, and just leaving it at that, just drifting into it or drifting through it, one has to tackle it seriously, systematically. So Buddhism lays down a path. It says if you want to evolve, if you want to develop morally and spiritually, if you want to perfect yourself in this way, there's a very definite way of doing it, if you really want to do it. And that is by following a path which Buddhism calls the Noble Eightfold Path. It's noble because it's followed by people who aspire to spiritual nobility, not the aristocracy of birth, and it's called eightfold because it consists of eight successive steps. If one wants to understand Buddhism on the practical side, if one wants to get at the heart of Buddhism practically speaking, then one has to advert to this Noble Eightfold Path. Pick up any book on Buddhism, it's sure to have a chapter at least on the Noble Eightfold Path. This is the essence, as it were, of the practical program of Buddhism. So what are these eight steps or stages? First of all, right understanding. Literally, right view. Getting things in right perspective. Buddhists consider this very important. This is why it's the first step, not belief. Not faith, but understanding. Right understanding of what we call the Four Noble Truths. First of all, the truth that life as we lead it now, life as we live it now, is not satisfactory. There's something missing, there's something lacking. Now this is a truth which for most people is understood only as a result of experience. Usually we think, or usually we take for granted, that life is pleasant enough, and up to a point it is. But a time comes, especially as we get older, when we start feeling, well, I've had it all, just as the Buddha had had it all. But surely there isn't something, Surely there must be something more than this, something deeper, something higher. Now remember, there's a very famous little passage in St. Augustine, whom you might have heard of, where he says in the Confessions, addressing God, he says, "Thou hast made us for thyself, and our hearts are restless until they find rest in thee." So what does this mean? One need not necessarily put it theistically. What it really means is this: that deep down in every human heart, or soul if you like to use the Christian word, there is something which is not of this world. If you like to use the word spiritual, you can use that. Some spiritual element, right deep down in oneself. And this spiritual element can only be satisfied by something spiritual. It can't be satisfied with anything which is worldly. There is a level of your being which is satisfied with worldly things. You go to a dance or have a nice new frock, of course it's pleasant to enjoy all that. But your whole life can't be made up of such things or such satisfactions. You might go through life being very successful, get everything that you want, have a happy marriage, so many children, might see your husband successful, all these things, but deep down there will be something which is unsatisfied, something which requires a deeper, a broader, if you like, a higher, a profounder satisfaction, and that is the spiritual element in man. So the first noble truth teaches us to recognize this, that so long as this is unsatisfied, as long as there's no provision for this spiritual element in the life of man, man will experience frustration and dissatisfaction. I mentioned at the beginning of this talk how many differences I noticed after coming back to this country after 20 years. One of the things I've noticed is that so many people nowadays suffer from all sorts of mental disturbances, all sorts of neuroses. They're not mentally at rest. They don't know peace of mind. It's extraordinary the number of people I've met who've had quite extensive psychoanalytical or psychotherapeutic treatment. Some of them day after day, every day, for several years. And some psychoanalysts say that if you want really to do something about yourself, you have to have daily analysis of 1 hour of that for about anything from 10 to 12 years, if you want to be really balanced. Many people have it for 2 or 3 years. Now before, there wasn't any such thing. But the strains and the tensions of modern life are such, it seems, that this is the sort of result, this is the sort of reaction. And one of the reasons why people experience these things in this way is that this spiritual element within themselves, or this spiritual aspect of their own being, doesn't find any satisfaction, doesn't find any solace. You find that experiences, say experience of bereavement, which shouldn't very deeply affect a normal, balanced person, can even break a person down, because there's nothing within themselves on which to fall back. No inner source of strength. It's rather interesting in this connection that only a few days ago a woman came to me, comes here regularly, comes to the meditation classes, and she said, "I'm sorry I couldn't come for so many weeks, but I've been away in Paris because my father was dying." And she said, "I had to nurse him, and after 4 to 5 weeks he did die. Then there was the settling up of the estate, all sorts of practical things." And she said, "It was really a terrible time that I had." She said, "There was only one thing which supported me, and that was the meditation which I learned in this class. If it hadn't been for that," she said, "I think I would have broken down." So this is what we find. When no provision is made for this deeper aspect of ourselves, we are in danger of breaking down. So this is what we have to understand, in Christian terms, that man does not live by bread alone. If we try to live by bread alone, not even bread, sometimes just a stone, to take another term from the gospel itself, a stone even. If we try to live in that way, then there's no deep, no inner satisfaction, only frustration and suffering. Because some aspect of ourselves, perhaps the best aspect of ourselves, is being denied its fulfillment. So first, right understanding, a recognition that in our lives there must be some spiritual element, some spiritual activity for full and complete happiness. This is what we call right understanding. Now the next step is what we call right aspiration, or even right emotional attitude. The first step is intellectual, to get things in a correct perspective. The second step is emotional, and it consists in three related states of love, compassion, and generosity. These are three great virtues in Buddhism, rather like faith, hope, and charity in Christianity. Love, compassion, and generosity. This is the emotional attitude corresponding to our right understanding. And this is the second step. These three together, love, compassion, and generosity. So the first step of the Eightfold Path is the right understanding, the intellectual side. And the second step is the right emotional, attitude, which is the emotional or the feeling side. So these two must go together. If you've got intellectual understanding and no emotional attitude, then you're dry and unbalanced. Similarly, if you've got lots of emotion but no intellectual understanding, you become a sentimentalist and your feelings may carry you away. So both together, or one after the other, understanding and then emotion, feeling. Then thirdly, what we call right speech. Now Buddhism, we may say, attaches very great importance indeed to right speech. There are four kinds of right speech in Buddhism. Speech which is truthful, speech which is kindly and affectionate, a speech which is useful to the person to whom you are speaking, and finally, speech which promotes concord, speech which helps to bring people together, not to divide them, no backbiting, no gossip, things of that sort. So fourfold right speech: truthful, kindly, useful, and promoting concord. Then fourthly, we have right action. Right action in Buddhism for the layperson consists of the observance of five precepts, corresponding perhaps to the latter half of the Christian Ten Commandments. That is the precept not to take life, the precept not to take what is not given, the precept not to commit sexual misconduct, the precept not to tell falsehoods, and the precept not to take intoxicating drinks and drugs, anything which clouds one's awareness. So all Buddhists, whether monks or lay people even, are expected to observe these five precepts of ethical behavior.